is a presentation of the Black Hollywood Live Network, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. Hollywood redefined. From Los Angeles, California, streaming live thanks to Akamai Technologies, this is Black Hollywood Live, the Black Tea Party, featuring weekly discussions on political news and current affairs. Black Hollywood Live, Hollywood redefined.
You're listening to Black Hollywood Live.
And now, the host of Black Hollywood Live, the Black Tea Party.
Ooh, I like the song coming back. I like the song coming back. What's up, you guys? Thanks so much for joining us. This is going to be an amazing episode. I'm your host, Stacey Ike. You guys can check me out on Twitter and Instagram at One Take Stace during the show. I am ready to go with my phone charged, and I have lovely co-hosts with me today. Introduce yourselves. We have a guest.
How you doing, guys? My name is Amir Zendanam. I am the chairman of California's 54th Assembly District Republican Central Committee and also the host of In the Clear with Amir on Z420 TV.
Nice. It's good to be with you guys today. Love it.
Thanks for being with us. Yeah, thank you guys for having me on. It's a pleasure.
It's going
to
be great.
We're excited to have you. Hi, everybody. I'm Julian Dujeric. You can catch me all across the board at Julian Dujeric on Twitter and Instagram. Plug your stuff so people can follow you.
Yeah. You can check me out on Twitter, Amir Zendanam. I guess you guys should probably put that at the bottom because I don't know if you guys can spell that. And you can check me out on Instagram if you want to see me do like yoga and flips and stuff, at Amir RZ. It's outside of the political world. I do things too.
I'm like looking up Instagram as we speak.
I do cool backflips and flips and tricks.
Yeah, I'm all about the flips. I love it. Awesome. Okay, so this is a really amazing episode to have a guest on because, of course, we had the debate. We've had some crazy stuff going on with Flint and Michigan. It's just a long list of craziness going on in the world as usual. So we can just jump into the first topic, which is what's going on in Flint. Does anybody have anybody that lives there or friends or any of that kind of stuff?
I know a friend of mine is from there, and I actually didn't know what was happening in Flint until I saw on Facebook that she had posted an Al Jazeera report from a year ago voicing the concerns of the people, and I was just blown away. But I mean, I have a lot of opinions on it, but I don't know anybody personally except her, and I didn't know about it until she told me about it.
Yeah.
So it was shocking for me.
Yeah, like you said, the governor, you know, a lot of people are going after the governor over there because of this cover-up that they had. And like you said, Al Jazeera reported on this a year ago, and it was a problem from a year ago. And now today, you know, just typical of government, when the problem actually comes to the public, that's when they have to deal with it.
Yeah.
But before that, just, you know, sweep it under the rug until it's time to...
It's interesting what publications decided to cover it a year ago. Al Jazeera was one I saw. I think the BBC did something about it.
The BBC actually the BBC was sourcing Al Jazeera's report. Al Jazeera was the first domestic news agency to talk about it.
Right.
And every subsequent report from all the mainstream media came as a result of that.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes sense because Al Jazeera is kind of awesome. But anyway, that's another story. So I think in case somebody doesn't know what's going on in the... in Michigan, basically, the governor was trying to save money, and they hired somebody. I wanted to get his name correct. Michael Brown. They hired a guy named Michael Brown to come in and decide where to cut budgets. Mm-hmm. And because they hired a contractor like that, I think he didn't have to follow protocol, basically.
Yeah.
So he can kind of cut without asking, you know, several different people or whatever, going through the regular procedure. So he decided to cut some of the water budget, and they said, okay, well, let's just source out of the Flint River for now and you know, take off the trail of Detroit water, do the Flint River for now, and I think they said in a year we'd revisit it and figure it out kind of thing. They just left it really open-ended. And as you can... Obviously, that was a very stupid idea. And I read that now that they're trying to, you know, pick up the pieces again, even the bringing it back to using Detroit water cost $12 million. Mm-hmm. You know, things like, I just can't believe how much it costs, I guess, to have a protective city, but it's necessary. And those budgets are not something that could be cut. I don't know.
What did you guys... One of the big things about this, the thing that's happening in Flint right now, is that a lot of people are blaming this on capitalism, the natural scapegoat that everybody uses every mm-hmm. time government screws something mm-hmm. up. But it's like, there's nothing capitalistic about a government giving one private company right. a monopoly to do something
right.
and then saying that's capitalism. That is not capitalism. If it was capitalism, the government wouldn't be picking and choosing winners. So another thing is that I see people making this a black-white issue, like we see a lot of the times with pretty much everything that's happening mm-hmm, these days. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to focus on what's happening with the methane gas leak in Porter Ranch, which is like a rich white neighborhood. And, you know, the thing that's happening in Flint, like obviously it's lower income minorities and stuff. And people are saying, well, you know, you see the government, they just let this happen to poor black people. But what we're seeing right now is that in an upper middle class suburb in LA, the government's not giving a damn about them either.
Yeah.
And these people are getting sick of methane gas right now.
Yeah, it's race baiting at its worst. And I hate to see that in the mainstream media, because so many people have access to that information.
Yeah.
Because who doesn't have a television now? It's really disheartening for me to see it. And I'm glad you brought that up, because we see that so often with a lot of these reports about things that go wrong governmentally, politically, you know, and it's super frustrating. That's why I think it's important for media outlets, not to give toot our own horn, but I think it's important for media outlets like this and for alternative sources of media to inject what I consider to be a truer narrative.
I think a positive narrative as well, because I think, yes, we hear a lot of this, you know, black-white issue or whatever in a lot of different realms, but I think that cry or that topic should only be brought up when it's necessary, because sometimes you can definitely see this is a clear thing or whatever. In this situation, I didn't even see that. I see you took advantage of people. Black, white, yellow, green, you took advantage of people and you didn't pay attention to what, you know, their needs. And I think it is interesting, like Julian said, when the mainstream media, they do have so much power in terms of the stereotypes they perpetuate, the ideas they perpetuate, that kind of thing. So it is important for the smaller medias and for places that call out on bullshit, you know, and say this is really what the fact is. If we can go ahead and dissect our mind from a race issue right now, this is a people issue. This is bottom line, it's a people issue, and then right now it's a city issue, and we have to do something about it. And so I don't know, so I read a lot of articles about who's at fault, you know, and I thought, okay, it's easier to blame the governor or the guy that they came in, Michael Brown or whatever, EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Who is at fault to you guys?
But you
or
see,
is somebody at fault?
Every single thing that you just said was
a government agency.
So government is at fault for all of it.
Okay.
So, you know, what I try to commonly tell people is, like, it's not black versus white.
Right.
It's the state versus everyone.
Right,
because,
right.
It doesn't matter if you're white and rich or poor and black. The government doesn't care about you. Mm. And they don't care about screwing up the environment in your home. And they don't really care about your health. And this is happening to every kind of people. So, you know, I commonly see people focusing on, like, well, look, police are killing so many black people. It's like, yeah, they're killing everybody, you know? So what we need to do is come together. It doesn't matter what color we are. We need to come together and realize that our common enemy is the group of people like Governor Snyder who will go give his friend a contract. Like, those people are criminals. If we did something like that in our daily lives, we'd be in a cage for that.
Right.
But they do, and they're like, well, it's okay. We're the government, so sorry.
Hmm. Yeah. Did you... go ahead.
No, I was just going to harp on that. I think it's about holding them accountable. And I think when you see another thing that really frustrates me is when you see some of the reports, some of the rhetoric that's out there, blaming the victims, blaming the residents for not holding them accountable, when this all started in 2011 and there were protests, there were motions filed to stop this from happening. And the fact that it wasn't covered as extensively as it is being covered now.
Because something went terribly wrong.
But, you know, the residents had the foresight to know that it was a common thing. As in my understanding, I'm not from Flint, I've never been there, but according to my friend, it was like a joke that, you know, the Flint River is the dirtiest river in the world, and how could they possibly have a system in place to purify that water when it's so unpure? And this was something that the residents were talking about long before anything was to come out of the river, and long before this whole thing erupted into what it's erupted into. And so for me, I think it's irresponsible of the media, not that I've seen any news organization perpetuate this, but allow someone to use their platform to perpetuate that, which in my opinion is just as bad, blaming the victim. And I think it's reprehensible, and I think the media also should be called out on that as well.
Mm. Who calls them out?
We do.
So y'all gonna watch? Because we need you to watch. You know, it's stuff like that. That's interesting that we've had so many different topics on the show, Amir, where, you know, we have brought so many things to light and a different perspective based on, you know, opposite to the mainstream. And it's always interesting because every episode I always want to ask, okay, how do we call them out though? Because as media, we have a hand in this and we have to take it seriously. We can decide to say the exact same thing everybody else is saying and not look deeper, or we can decide to have our own opinions and be strong on that, which, you know, can be tough sometimes, or, you know. So it's always interesting just trying to figure out how do you get their attention and how do you understand.
Well, I actually have the perfect answer for that, because
the perfect answer?
I'm kind of like the living embodiment of what should you do when the government is just like screwing everybody over. And what me and a lot of other people did after the 2012 presidential election is that we all went and ran for local office. And that's how I became the chairman of my central committee, which is a local elected office around the country. So I'm the chairman of my Republican central committee, which makes me a part of the greater Los Angeles County Republican Party. So it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican or whatever, you can go run for these positions and make changes. One of the cool things we did last year, for example, was I was working for my friend's congressional campaign, and we saved Sriracha. I'm sure you guys remember like all the headlines about how the city's trying to shut down Sriracha. So we went there, we protested, we got people together, and we saved the company from cronies in that city government just trying to take a company out because they're not paying their interest bills. Right. And they're like, oh, well, there's a bad smell, so we need to take you out. But, you know, in reality, right, it's their best interest. So what we do is we go and face those people head on. And what I've noticed personally is that if you do get a good enough amount of people and have a concrete idea that you can be behind, you can really get these city councilors to change things. Mm. But you just have to pressure them, and you have to keep pressuring them and keep pressuring them. One of the shady things that the city governments do, and I'm sure they've done it in Flint, they're doing it in Porter Ranch right now, is that they'll have meetings. They'll say, okay, this is a public hearing. Then you have like hundreds of people come. And then they say, oh, well, sorry, the meeting's over today. 3 weeks from now, we're going to have another meeting. Mm. And then they go and then they reschedule that meeting. And then they're like, well, next month, we're going to have a meeting 50 miles away. So then, you know, 2 months later, they have a meeting and then nobody even hears about it anymore. And then they pass some resolution and all the people are like, well, what the hell just happened?
Wow.
So that's why we have to be very vigilant with what especially our city governments are doing. Because, look, this Flint issue is not happening because of the federal government. It's happening because of city governments and state governments. So it's the local governments that are screwing us over. And it's actually very easy, or easier than people think, to go to a city council meeting and make those city council members, you know, do something good. Because if we don't push them, they just continue the same BS that leads to what we have today. So I always tell people, like, go run for local office. Go do whatever you can to push your city council. Go run for city council. Go run for mayor. Like, these positions aren't very hard. Like, with my position, for example, not many people run for it. So all you have to do is put your name on the ballot, and then bam, you're an elected official, you know? So,
and be informed. That'd be good, too.
So, you know, that's what I say. It's like, go into the system and see what you could change through there. You know, you can make... I don't think that we can fix the system by being part of the system, but I think that we could protect ourselves as best as possible by being part of that system.
Interesting.
And I also think that in conjunction with the what's already happening, which is the democratization of information online, I think is super important. And we'll get into this a little bit during our next topic, but there are certain things that politicians can't get away with anymore because you can just Google, like I'm doing right now in preparation for our next topic, you can just Google it and call them out on their BS.
Right.
And so, yes, absolutely, I think that's important. I think also doing your homework and learning the positions of
that's
every
exactly
single candidate.
Ask, right.
It doesn't matter. I mean, I lean to the left on certain issues. I lean to the right on others. I grew up following and supporting the candidates and the side that I was taught to support. And, you know, through the internet, through just self-education, I realized that there are some things that I disagree with that are incongruent with how I was raised, and there are things that are. My grander point is, I think people need to do their homework. People need to stop being so lazy and, you know, really seek out the information. Otherwise, you're kind of just being shepherded into whatever it is that whoever's
that's
in power.
Really what I was
I think
ask.
I should mention, though, that the primary reason that I got involved in political activism was to educate people, because mm-hmm. I feel that if you're, look at Bernie Sanders, he just goes on a stage with thousands of people and he just says things and people are like, yeah, let's do it. And it's like,
but they all do that. It's not just a Bernie
right.
Sanders.
So that's the thing. It's as a politician, people take your ideas more seriously than if like you're going on a stage and saying some stuff, but you don't have a political credential. Mm-hmm. Like if you're a senator, somebody's going to take you more seriously than if you're not and you're talking about these issues. So like as mass appeal to educate on a mass level, I think it is good. Like if we look at the Ron Paul campaign, he woke up millions of individuals just by going on the Twitter. Floor of Congress right. and giving speeches about like how the Federal Reserve works or how the banking system works, you know? Like, he wasn't going up there talking about, like, why he's so great. He was just like, well, this is what's screwed up. Let me educate you guys about the issues. And, like, that's kind of what started this intellectual revolution that we have today.
What's so interesting is that you've both mentioned it, and I was actually thinking the exact same thing. Politicians really do have the power, might be the wrong phrase, but they take the risk of going up and saying whatever they want mm-hmm. in a lot of cases. And I always wonder, like, do they just assume that all of us are stupid? About 50% of us are stupid. 75%. I mean, do they not think we'll ever check? Because the truth is, if you're not interested in this world, then you probably aren't going to check. You know, you're going to take the headline for what it is and, you know, and go on with your day or whatever the case is, or go on believing that that's true. So it's interesting when I was looking through some of the things that Jillian sent for today's topics and some of the things I was fact checking. And I was just a little irritated because if I didn't have the show, or if I didn't have people in my life who were into politics more than I am even, and being surrounded by these topics, I might just be watching this at face value. So then I think of every other person who is not doing that and how they are so boldly going up there and mm-hmm. not having a problem with the fact that they, you know, I mean, I don't know.
As somebody who's worked on congressional campaigns and presidential campaigns, and I've taken classes on political training, the thing that they teach you is that
people,
people need to know this. Like, as political trainers, they teach you, like, most people don't care about the facts. Mm. Most people just care about what kind of emotion that you can talk to them about that can garner their support. Because that's the thing, like, as a political analyst, you have to, like, look at how the field is, and you're like, okay, well, if I go and talk to people about the Federal Reserve and how it functions, most people don't care about that. Mm. If I tell them they can get something for free, then they're going to be like, well, that has something to do with me. So now I care about it.
Wow.
So, you know, sadly, that's how politics is, because that's kind of like just how human nature is. Like, most of these people are just the herd. They'll follow the mass. The masses will follow whatever trend happens. So that's what I always say. If we want to create a better world, we don't really need to have the masses. It's always been a small group of people that have made drastic positive changes throughout history. Mm. So the masses will follow. You know, every time we've had positive, look at the abolition of slavery. You know, like, the masses for thousands of years were just like, yeah, that's cool, slavery is cool. And then, like, a few people were like, hey, maybe we shouldn't own humans. And then, at like in a 100-year span, like, most people in the world were like, yeah, maybe we shouldn't own humans.
Right,
okay, yeah, you
right.
know. And it wasn't the masses who thought of that. It was just like a small group of intellectual individuals. Right. And then eventually everybody's like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. Let's not own humans. You know?
That's so interesting.
You know, I just want to mention, because you mentioned Bernie Sanders, and I think it just easily transitions us into the Democratic debate, which is our
mm-hmm.
next topic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm often, and you and I have had several conversations about this, I'm conflicted in that I like his ideas. I just don't understand how he plans on
making them happen. Agree.
I agree too.
Because I like me some Bernie Sanders, y'all. I don't know. And I'm so sorry to cut you off, but I think just watching these debates, both Republican and Democratic, I think I've stepped back from deciding, like, oh, I'm this side and this side. I've just really wanted to take this year and pay attention a little bit more and just understand what everyone's talking about. And I do think that when we first started the show, or I'm sorry, when we first started talking about the 2016 election, we kind of all had this, it was a whole nother panel, and we kind of had this joke a little bit about Bernie Sanders in terms of he was older and what was he really talking about, blah, blah, blah. And then I started listening, and he has a lot of positive ideas. But specifically, how are these going to happen? Especially when it comes to us working. But continue. I feel like you kind of had that
I'd say the problem with Bernie Sanders is that he has great ideas. Yeah. Like, he brings up issues that we want to hear about.
Absolutely.
And other candidates just don't do that. Unless you're like Rand Paul or something, other candidates don't talk about issues that like our generation especially wants to hear about.
Right.
But it's his solutions that are just so dangerous, because his solutions have been tried and failed. His ideology is one of the most dangerous things that human history has ever seen, you know? But he just brands it as something new and, you know, he's like, oh, it's not socialism, it's democratic socialism. Mm. Like, it doesn't matter, that's still socialism, you know? And not to say, like, we're not a socialist country, like, America is pretty socialist, you know? So when you have, like, the Republicans who are like, oh, we can't have a socialist like Sanders, it's like, well, you guys support, like, socialist policies like police and military, which are, like, the biggest socialist policies of the country. But, you know, so, but the thing with Bernie Sanders is that I look at him as like, this is just the Obama deception version 2.0. Obama came in
2.0
the anti-war candidate, the candidate who will be friendly to civil liberties. And what did he do? He became president. He bombed more countries than Bush. He didn't even close Guantanamo. The war on drugs expanded. Police are still killing even more people now than under Bush.
Yeah, but even with stuff like that, it's very, some of those things I want to make sure I have my facts right before I say too much, but in general, some of those topics, though, it's easy to blame the person that's in president as they're happening. Police officers killing students, black, white, yellow, green, has nothing to do with Obama, though, does it?
Well, this is the thing, though. Well, I understand your argument, and I agree with that. Obama's Justice Department overlooks all of these departments in the state and local level, but let's say that you're right. Let's not focus on any of that. Let's focus on just Obama's executive orders, the things that he had to put his signature on to accomplish. What about when Obama assassinated a 16-year-old American boy named Abdulrahman al-Awlaki for no crime? He had no trial, no jury, none of that. They just went and killed him. He's a 16-year-old. He was a minor. It's illegal to execute a minor in America. Mm. But Obama went and signed an executive order, and they did it. So, you know, it's things like this that make it
impossible. You'll have to tweet about that topic or something, just so people can get a little bit more.
Yeah, and this was a really big issue a few years ago, a few years ago when it happened, because it set a precedent to be able to execute minors, and not just execute minors, but execute them without a trial or jury. Like, that's Obama saying, I am your executioner, and you don't get a trial. And you know what the reason was? His dad was making YouTube videos saying, like, death to America. And then they killed his dad, and then a few weeks later, the kid had nothing to do with his dad at all, and what he was saying killed him, too. Just some 16-year-old kid from Colorado. So that is something Barack Obama signed to make happen. And if somebody is signing orders to kill people, to kill innocent people, or to kill people who they don't even give a trial to, I can't defend that. Like, I can't say that that's any different than what George Bush was doing. And I don't think that Bernie Sanders is going to be any different.
So. I think as far
interesting
as
point.
Yeah,
interesting
well, I think point. This is how I feel like President Obama got into office. He was running for office on this premise, and I really do believe that he believed the things he was saying. I don't think, as you say.
Well, I mean, you're looking at Hillary's funding over there. Go look at Obama's funding in 2008. It was almost identical to Hillary's. So
that's true. I think once you get into the presidency, you see the reality of the world and the decisions you have to make. I don't see that as an excuse to then go in the opposite direction, because I do have some issues with his foreign policy specifically. I think there was a, I don't know if it was the New York Times or Huffington Post, I know for sure Glenn Greenwald talked about it on his website. His drone policy, his drone strikes, I think it was over 90% of casualties under Obama's drone program over the years are not intended targets. And so my question is, if the majority of the people that die under your program are not terrorists, is there
and
something
usually
wrong?
Usually, like kids, and women, and old people.
Well,
and, you know,
innocent people.
Yeah. Innocent people.
Yeah. Is there then an issue with your program? I think there is. I think that's a question that needs to be asked more.
And
I'm
Bernie
surprised.
Sanders supports Barack Obama's drone war, and he said he would continue it as well.
Right. Well, Bernie Sanders has voted to fund the war, the argument is that, you know, you don't want to take money away from troops that are already there.
They're already there.
If you believe, if you're an anti-war candidate, or if you're an anti-war president, then you should be anti-war across the board.
Well,
no?
Yeah. So I like to bring up Dennis Kucinich. He was a Democrat running in the last election, and Ron Paul was running in the last election too, and they were. both in Congress, and you could go look at their voting records for funding wars, and they weren't, and this isn't, we're not talking about funding wars. Bernie Sanders was not funding a war. He was funding an occupation. Mm. There's a big difference between a war and occupying a country,
right,
and then voting over and over and over to continue occupying it. Dennis Kucinich was a Democrat, and he was running for president, and his congressional record showed that he never supported that kind of stuff. Ron Paul was running for president. He never supported that kind of stuff. So,
and you don't think those positions wouldn't change once you got into presidency?
Well, but that's the thing. Like, one of the things with Obama was people were saying that he was anti-war as well, but I was telling people back in 2007, go look at his voting record. Mm-hmm. Go look at what he actually supports. It's not anti-war. Because if you're actually anti-war, that means that war is the last solution that you would use, right? So when Bernie Sanders is going there and saying that, like, we need to go have airstrikes on Syria, we need to give Ukrainian rebel Nazis a $1 billion aid package, we need to sanction Iran more, you know, these are not anti-war positions,
solutions.
You know, like, this is what a warmonger sounds like. This sounds no different than, like, Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton, you know? He just makes it sound a little bit nicer when he says, I'm going to go kill people.
So if you're talking about both sides, what is really the... The difference? Am I? I don't know. I don't know what
difference
to say. What's the difference?
They're both the war parties.
That's what I'm. You know, I think that's been a conversation I've had with friends over the past few weeks when we're just trying to internalize what everybody's saying. And when you start feeling like you're not hearing that many different ideas, you don't really know what side to root for. And that's where you become. I don't know if maybe that's why you decided. You're like, I'm a libertarian, or that's, or whatever the case is. And for some people, they're like, I'm a nobody, or I'm a nothing, or whatever, because I just don't know where to.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks for a lot of Americans.
And like, I grew up as a liberal Democrat. Now I am a Republican. I'm not conservative, but I am leaning to the right. But like you were just saying, I don't care if you have a D or an R next to your name. I'm looking for what's right, what's moral, what's practical. So that's why, as Republicans in LA County, what we do with the Republican Liberty Caucus, which is an organization I'm the secretary for the LA County chapter, is that we reach out to every kind of group. Democrat, socialist, communist, conservative, anybody who wants to work with us to reach a common goal, we will work with them. And I don't care, like, I don't care if you're a Trump supporter. If we can find one thing that we can find in common that we can work together on, I'll do it. Because that's kind of like the future. Like, look at us three right now. We're just sitting here and we're not going like, I'm on this side, you're on that mm-hmm. side. We're just like, well, why don't we just like figure out what's right and what's wrong? Mm-hmm. Forget like if it has a D or an R next to your mm-hmm. name. Like, let's just figure out what's moral and what's practical. Mm-hmm. You know?
Julian, chime in here.
I just wanted to ask, like, is there any opposition or any question that you being in the Republican Party, and you support gay marriage and you support for marijuana legislation,
well,
marijuana legalization.
Freedom, so.
Right. So is that ever kind of just weird to people? I don't want to use the word weird, but are people ever kind of taken aback by that at all?
The modern day Republican Party is far away from what the classical Republican Party was supposed to be about. If you look at the Republican Party in the 50s, for example, there is a big tradition of being anti-war mm-hmm. in the Republican Party. So when Ron Paul was going up and saying, hey, let's not kill people, let's not go and put military bases on every country in the planet, you know, like, these were actually traditional Republican values. And what actually happened in the 60s, and this is actually a negated part of history, is that a lot of communist-leaning Democrats went over to the Republican Party, and that's actually how modern neoconservatism started. They were left-leaning communists who didn't see a place for themselves in the Democratic Party, so they went and became Republicans. So that's actually when the downfall, I guess,
of
the Republican, like what we see today in the Republican
yeah.
Party. And then, of course, in the 90s, when the evangelical Christians,
right.
You know, took control of, like, a big chunk of the party. But I mean, I'd say that the biggest opposition I face is through my own party. Like, when I talk to Democrats and stuff, yeah, like, because they think that I'm a liberal because, like, I believe in things like marriage equality and, you know, like, you could put whatever you want in your body. And that's the thing, like, I don't like to paint myself in these bubbles of, like, I support cannabis legalization or decriminalization is what I support. Or, like, I support gay marriage. It's like, no, I support freedom. I support your freedom to do whatever you want as long as you're not hurting anybody else.
Okay.
So, that's what our parents teach us. Like, don't hit people to get what you want. Like, be nice. Like, persuade people to get what you want. So that's all I'm saying. Like, if you ask my policy position on anything, and like people commonly try to paint me as like, oh, look, he's just a Republican. But my position on everything is this. If you have to use violence and threats of violence to get what you want, it's not a good idea. So when Bernie Sanders is saying like, yeah, taxing you 90% of your income, yeah, I'd consider that. It's like, dude, do you understand what that means? That means you will send men with guns to my house to threaten me if I don't pay you my money that I honestly worked for, you know?
For something that I don't believe in.
For something, right. I just don't believe in using coercion to get what you want, whether it's in government or in your regular life. I think the biggest problem we face in the world, really, is that we have a different set of standards and morality for government and for us. So, like, we think we're like, it's not okay to hit, steal, and kill, but it's okay when the government does it. So all I'm saying is, like, we should live in a society where everybody's following the same rules. You know, like, if a cop kills somebody, they shouldn't get away with it. Like, they should be tried for murder, just like if I killed somebody.
They should,
you know?
But if we live in a, you know, even though that last sentence, we should live in a society where everyone plays by the same rules, I think it's almost impossible, personally. I think it's an interesting notion, and it's probably very something that I wish, you know, we could really come together on. Because even some of the things you're saying, I'm like, well, then do you even feel like it's necessary to identify as a Republican? Do you have to identify as anything at this point?
And that's,
you know,
actually what I'm kind of getting through with my progression is, like, I don't really feel like I need to identify. Because when I identify as a Republican and the first thing I say to you is, I'm the chairman of the Republican Central Committee, you automatically look at me in a certain light without anything else being said just because I said the word Republican, right? Like, most people do,
okay,
right?
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Like, if I just met you and I was like, hey, I'm Amir, I'm the chairman of the Republican Central Committee.
Well, I wasn't expecting to hear that based on, like, our 5 minutes before the show.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is if you tend to be politically inastute, if you're not following politics from an intellectual perspective, you tend to ascribe tenets of republicanism to a person who identifies as a Republican without actually understanding or listening to their views on things. So I think that's what you're trying to say.
And the thing is, like, we live in a two-party monopoly in this country.
Yeah.
So, you know, third parties don't win. Historically, it's impossible. Like, if another party were going to win, it would have happened in the last 100 years or something, right? Like, at least a congressional seat. Like, the Libertarian Party is the third biggest party in the country, but they've never won a congressional seat. So it's like, we have to understand that, like, look, Bernie Sanders is a democratic socialist. Hillary is more of, like, a conservative Democrat. Mm-hmm. Like, there are different perspectives in each party.
Right.
So
right.
It's sad that we only have two parties, but
what would people do? Like,
we'd be like most of the rest of the world.
Wow.
They just
that's
have,
true.
Like, a bunch of different political parties, and it kind of works
then the best ideas would win out. There's something that I've actually always wanted to have a conversation with you about. Are you talking about how you would like to have everything be privatized, from security to basically any goods and service be privatized? I'm wondering, when it comes to the judicial system, how do you determine who's more just than the other?
Oh, man, we just jump from politics
I have you here, bro.
Right. That's a lot.
I might as well get it in right now. I love talking about it.
Then we have to get into Iran, because
So, another thing is, like, just like the word Republican, privatization is a bad, scary word. Like, when you tell people, let's privatize. Mm. We grow up in our system learning that privatization is bad. The reason bad things happen is because of privatization. But in reality, when we look at, like, Flint, they call that privatization. Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, you see, that's privatization, so you need more government. But you're like, but that's not actually privatization in the first place, so that's why it's not working.
Well, explain why. Because
the system that I believe in, going off of the philosophy of freedom, is that I believe that every interaction between humans should be voluntary and mutual, right? Like, you should agree with something and I should agree with something before we go through a deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not acceptable if I put a gun to your head and say, like, my grandma needs medical care, give me $500 or I'll shoot you. Like, that's not how a deal works.
Right,
like,
right.
I don't want a society like that. But our relationship with government today is structured like that. Do this or else. And that's not really, like, that's not a good way to, like, live, you know? Mm-hmm. Do this or else, like, we'll hurt you. Like, what kind of sick, twisted way is that for us in 2016 to be living?
Yeah.
So all I think is that everything that we do, whether it's police or military or courts, healthcare, education, it should all be mutual, voluntary. Like, if I don't want the LAPD to represent me as my security service, shouldn't I have the right, at least the right, to call somebody else, to call another company that says, hey, we don't kill people
as
easily.
Who is somebody else?
Well, in what we're talking about, like, in a hypothetical private society.
Okay.
But I will bring up a real-life example, too. People say things like, well, if we privatize everything, because we already see the privatization model for healthcare, education, these things, but we take it one step further and say, well, if the privatization model produces the best goods and services for humanity, then why don't we just take the logical conclusion of that and just say, why don't we just privatize everything? Which includes things like police and courts, because aren't those, like, the shadiest things that, like, criminal justice, our police, like, these are the biggest problems we're facing
in
our country.
Most reform.
Why is that? Because they're monopolized services. And just like any monopolized service, prices go up and quality drops. And these are just economic laws. If you monopolize services, this is what happens. If you privatize services, look at this. You guys, look at this. These things, this technology 10 years ago would have been $10,000. And now it's like $1,000. And how amazing is that? It's because of competition. So if we could have competition at a level that could produce this amazing technology here, how do you think the police would be in a society where they actually had to compete for their jobs? So Exactly. So, and the thing is, this would actually stop the problem of police brutality as well. An example of this, we have an example actually in America right now. So one of the things people always say is like, well, this is just hypothetical, like this doesn't actually exist. Okay, but it does exist on a small level. But Detroit, right now, Detroit has a private security company that acts as police in certain neighborhoods because Detroit is essentially bankrupt and the city government cannot really pay their police to patrol.
So they
did
get rid of half of their...
Exactly. Yeah. But where do you think that they stopped patrolling? The worst areas.
Right.
So... as a result, this private security firm came into these neighborhoods and they said, well, if you give us a small payment every month, we'll protect your neighborhoods. The kicker is, the argument back would be like, oh, well, you know, in a privatized model, what about the poor? It's always, well, the poor can't afford it, right?
Or even just competing. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but even just competing security firms. Like, wouldn't
warlords take over? Wouldn't they just kill each other and fight, right? Like, that's our common inclination is, like, we think, well, if there's, like, two LAPDs competing to be the best, wouldn't they be killing each other?
Yeah.
But no.
I mean, you would hope not, but continue.
Well, because in a privatized system, like, in a market society, it's not in Samsung and Apple's best interest to take up arms and go kill each other to win, right? Because they're like, hell no, that's going to take away from our profits. Right. Government gets their bombs and guns from taxation. Mm-hmm. So it's not actually their money that they're spending. So they're going to be irresponsible with their spending. So the whole idea is if we have a privatized model where everybody has the incentive, like if you're a security guard, I was working at a place one time, the security guard took out his gun and he got fired. So that's how a privatized model looks. In LA, 20 cops just come out and shoot some crippled guy, and they're like, well, we're going to go home, no problem.
Right.
They have their job the next day, and then they blame it on the victim. So all I'm saying is that if we have already seen that a privatized model makes every single technology in this room at a low price, then why can't we just use that logic in courts, military, police services?
It would be interesting to see if it applies the same way in all of those different areas. You're saying it does, basically.
From the examples, because that's the thing. I don't like to base my beliefs off speculation and opinion. I like actual worldly examples. So the Detroit model is actually great because that's happening in America. There are models around the rest of the world, but I like to bring up the Detroit model. And one of the great things is that in the poorer neighborhoods where the people can't afford their services, they still go in for free as charity. So the greatest thing about a privatized model is that when you have your own company and you're not being taxed 50% of your money, you're like, well, instead of my money being taxed 50% to go kill little kids in Afghanistan and Iraq, I could just go give this to the poor communities myself. And that's why America has actually been the most charitable country statistically in history. It's because, like, we've had this more of a free model, which lets us keep more of our money until today, because, like, we're taxed to hell today. But, like, say 50 years ago, America was so charitable because we were like, well, hey, I have so much money left. Here you go, poor person, take some money, you know?
It's an interesting topic, and I really wish we could dive
into it. Yeah, I know, that's the thing. Like, going into that kind of philosophy.
It's something that a lot of us, you know, probably don't don't think about. I appreciate that.
And that's why, you know, going into that, it's like, that's not really what Republicans are talking about. The fact that we're talking about, like, a new system. The way that I look at myself is, like, if you saw abolitionists in America in the 1800s, I kind of look at myself as a modern-day abolitionist. Like, the abolitionists of the 1800s in America abolished one of the most horrid institutions, which was slavery. And what I'm just trying to do is live in a society where the most horrid institution, government, is, like, non-existent in our lives. Like, they are to the point where they do not interfere in our lives at all.
Interesting.
I want to talk to you much about this, but we do have one more topic.
This is like a three-hour show.
This is it. Right. We have to jump into our last topic, which is Iran. And I'm very interested to see what you guys think about this. Hearing Obama come out and talk to us a little bit about it. And he started his speech when he said, this is a really good day, you know, about three Americans being freed. And Julian, you're moving your head. What are you thinking?
No, I think it was whenever situations like that are de-escalated, I think that's great. What was interesting to me is that it happened hours before, and I think it's a good thing. I'm not criticizing the decision. I think it's ultimately good. Three or four hours before Iran basically got its money back.
Right.
Because they complied with the Iran nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. But my biggest thing is, without hesitation, even seemingly without much knowledge on the issue, the Republicans seem to have jumped on it with such authority, right? And it is such a complicated issue. I mean, there's a situation where it's essentially an international incident, and, you know, it's heightened even more so due to the fact that we have this deal with Iran, which has been heavily criticized on the right. I would think that everyone
and on the left, Hillary Clinton has criticized it as
well. That's true. Yeah, on the right and the left. Yeah. It's
more on the right.
Bipartisanly criticized. But I would think that people would, knowing the sensitivity of the issue at large, which is trying to obtain peace around the world, which is essentially what I think this deal is all about. Mm-hmm. The perpetuation of this narrative of Iran being bad, and look, I'm not defending Iran or defending any country for that matter. I think the U.S. has just as many skeletons in their closet as Iran, and so either
way more.
Absolutely. But,
way more.
Okay.
Iran hasn't attacked a country in over 200
right.
years.
I think there's plenty of blame to go around, but
right.
I would think that the motivation would be de-escalation. And it just seems to me that more so on the right, it seems to be that the Republicans, the ones running for office now, only want war. Like, what they're saying is very charged language.
Right.
And I don't really see how that's conducive to peace. Because
it's not their prerogative. Peace isn't their prerogative.
I think, but it also, sometimes, like, as we can see, when people like Trump decide to become radical, mm-hmm. you see the influence on people who might not be too educated on both right, left, yellow, green, whatever, up, down, they take to that because I said it last week, it plays into their fears. So if you're saying, hey, let's start war and that'll stop everything, you would think that we have grown from that narrative, but I think every time we hear it, somehow it still resonates with people, and enough people for polls, for it to affect polls. So I think I understand what Julian's saying in terms
Before we get into that, I just want you to, like, briefly explain the situation in Iran, if you can.
Well, okay, so this is what I, like, looked up. I don't have Iran complies with
the
deal.
You know a lot more about it.
Oh, okay.
Well,
can you please do not let me do it, because I have, like, printouts and stuff.
We have
go
three
ahead.
Minutes?
Yeah,
I'll do this fast. Okay,
so do it in minutes so that we can respond.
So the important thing about the whole Iran deal is that we have to look at Iran's history first. Iran's history with America, at least, kind of starts around 1953. Iran had a democratically elected secular government. They had a democratically elected prime minister. His name was Mohammad Mossadegh. And what he wanted to do was nationalize the oil. So what the UK and America would have to do when they take Iran's oil is, like, pay them some of the money back. Because before that, they were like, we're just going to take all your oil and screw you guys.
Right.
So Iran was like, well, give us some of our oil money, man. So
the CIA was like, yeah, we don't like that. We're going to overthrow your democracy and instill a dictator. So they instilled a dictator, Shah Reza Pahlavi. And then in 1979, because he was an American-backed dictator, the people got radicalized, and then they overthrew his government for a government that they all thought was going to supposedly be better. The result was the Islamic Republic of Iran, which arguably is not better. But so... But now we have today, because after 1979 happened, American and Iranian relationships split right there. The hostage situation situation happened. The Iran-Iraq war happened, where Iraq was getting all their money and weapons from America to go use on the Iranians. So we've had like this over 30-year history with Iran, where the American Empire has been trying to take over Iran. So it was like, they need to get Iraq, they need to get Libya, they need to get Syria. But the prize for the neocons in America is, we need to take Iran, because
based on resources.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The thing, like, it's very hard historically to take over that land of Iran. You know, like, Iraq, Afghanistan, you go to, but you don't attack Iran. And because Iran, if you look at the geography, it's just mountains, like, all around the country. Mm-hmm. So it's, from a military standpoint, it's hard.
It's geographically hard.
But the amazing thing about these sanctions being lifted is, one, it normalizes relations, but more importantly for me and my family, like, people in Iran can get access to medicine, you know, technology. Like, people are dying in Iran because America's like, sorry, you can't go get that medicine for cancer research, and you guys are all just going to go die. Sorry, suckers. So now I think it's so important that Iran and America are having normalized relations, because I think that Iran should be America's greatest ally in the Middle East, not these belligerent allies like Saudi Arabia and Israel who are just going around the world and just destroying everything. And then America, the big brother, has to say, oh, sorry, guys, my little brother just screwed up again. Iran doesn't do that. Like, Iran is not as belligerent around the world as Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Can you say what... Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you have a question.
You have a question, too.
Okay. I was just going to say, you know, just to harp on that point, it isn't politically advantageous for them to do so, is what some people would argue. What is your response?
Well, see, the thing is, like, it all comes down to the whole nuclear bomb issue. Mm-hmm. And it's like, first of all, who cares if Iran has a nuclear bomb? America, the country telling them to stop making nuclear bombs, has used them twice on civilians and, like, dropped, like, about 1,000 nuclear bombs in tests, like, around the world, just destroying the environment with their nuclear bombs. And they're trying to tell Iran not to do it.
Yeah, but Obama mentioned that.
This is the kicker, is that American politicians keep saying that Iran is building a bomb. Iran wants to build a bomb. Mossad, Israel's intelligence service, and the CIA have come out over and over and over again and said that Iran is not looking to build a nuclear bomb. But then you have the neocons and, you know, the Israelis and Saudis going around and just continuing and saying, well, they're making a bomb. Israel has nuclear bombs. Israel does not let atomic inspectors into their country to look at their nuclear program.
Right.
But they're forcing Iran, who doesn't have one nuclear bomb, for inspectors to go in there.
How do you, and this is just a question I think that I want to get out, and I hope that, how do you define the leading to the sanction, like the sanction being lifted and this normalization.
We do have to wrap.
Try to answer that, please.
Going off like my theme of markets being greater than governments, it's because there's so much business that has been wanting to come out of Iran right now, and the sanctions have been gripping them tight, that people, it's just businessmen. They're like, I want to go do business in Iran. There's a lot of money in Iran. They have so much oil. They have so much, like, Iranians are one of the most, statistically, one of the most educated people on the planet. Mm-hmm. So, like, these people are doctors, engineers, they're scientists, like, the Iranians can contribute to the world on a grand scale, and I think we're going to see that now that these sanctions are lifted. Already, we've seen that Iran bought 114 Airbus planes from Europe, and, like, it's just things like this, you know, they had planes that were just crashing, and civilians were dying because, you know, they couldn't get the parts for planes. Mm. So I think the best thing that's going to come out of this is that the normal common people are the ones who are going to benefit most, not the
which
so
ultimately is the best for
that's
everybody.
The best solution.
It's the best solution.
So if there's one thing Obama's done in his presidency that I will give him fame for...
One thing in 8 years. That is so...
Two things in eight years. That is from Amir himself. Cuba normalization relations with Cuba and the Iran deal. I think those are the only two things that I will say, good job, Barack Obama. That was good, man.
It was really awesome having you on the show. Can we give a quick clap?
Thank you so much.
That's so awesome. Please give your Twitter. Where can everybody keep in touch with you?
You can check me out out Twitter at Amir Zendanam. Again, try to spell that out if you can. easier if you check me out on Instagram at Amir RZ.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on. Yes, thank you so much for being here. Yeah, your passion. Yeah. It was really great.
Quickly, you can catch me across the board on all social media. Look here at Julian Dujeric, Instagram, Twitter, all of that. And Stacey.
Thank you guys so much for watching. I just love you guys when you watch. You're amazing. You guys can check me out on Twitter and Instagram at One Take Stace. You were awesome. Thanks for being with us. And we will see you next Friday.
See ya.
See ya.
From executives Kevin Undergaro, Dario Christian, Tiana Hobson, and the entire BHL staff, we would like to thank you for supporting Black Hollywood Live, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. For questions and comments, contact us. info@blackhollywoodlive.com. Like us on Facebook, tweet us, or Instagram us at BHL Online. And I am the official voice of Black Hollywood Live, Scipio, Instagram at KingXOBay. Thanks for tuning in. The views expressed here are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or customers.